Chapter 13. I asked Lady Arryk to call her associates to the Overlook. Before all the others had taken their seats, I made sure to position myself directly opposite Pinky, so that there was no chance of either of us avoiding the other's gaze. I wanted him to look into my eyes, and know that I meant every word of what I was about to say. But my first question was for Lady Arryk. How detailed is the Swine Queen's knowledge of your operations here?
In what capacity?
Does she know the names and faces of everyone involved, the number of people around this table?
No,
Lady Arryk answered carefully, eyeing me with interest, as if she already had a strong sense of where I was going.
Her contact with us was confined to the extraction operation alone. She knows the identities of some of those who escaped back into orbit with us, but nothing of those who were already here.
Good. I nodded. Then there shouldn't be any difficulty presenting me as one of your own. When you hand Pinky over to the Swine Queen, you'll make me part of the same exchange. Some mild interest registered on his face.
You think I need someone to hold my hand, Stink?
No, I said evenly, refusing to be baited. I'm in no doubt at all that you're perfectly capable of doing this on your own, especially if you're sober. But since I initiated the idea, it seems only fair that I accept my share of the risk. We'll go in together. Glass will have to manufacture 2 samples of the hemoclast and provide 2 spare suits instead of 1, but it doesn't complicate the operation in any way.
Unacceptable, Glass said. I found him. He's my asset. I won't see him risked.
But you will countenance Pinky being exposed to the same danger, Lady Arryk asked. Is his life somehow less valuable than Clavain's?
Glass gave her answer due reflection.
Yes.
Well, it's good to get your prejudices out in the open, Pinky said.
Clavain is tactically critical to the 2nd and 3rd phases of this operation. You are not without your talent. But there is a difference between useful and irreplaceable.
Thank you for that warm endorsement, Glass, I said, but I'm going down with Pinky. It's not a question of whether I do or don't, but of how we make it work.
Pinky regarded Snowdrop.
Wonder what made the guy grow a spine overnight.
We came to an accommodation,
Snowdrop said, eyeing me with something that was not yet approbation, but at least the recognition that I was not totally beneath consideration. I had a spine. I just needed reminding. I paused. I'm not asking for your friendship or respect, Pinky. I know I haven't done nearly enough for that. Just your cooperation. Acting together, I believe we can increase the chances of getting you out of there.
The terms of the exchange are already settled, Lady Arryk said, shaking her head slowly. Pinky for the stones. The Swine Queen won't understand why I'd offer more than I need to. That will make her suspicious, maybe even expecting a trap. That, in turn, will jeopardize the stones.
Which is why we won't do it that way. I'll be a last-minute offering, a scrap of meat thrown to the dogs. There was silence. I was certain that none of Lady Arryk's close associates were comfortable with the idea of Pinky going to the swinehouse, but each had accepted, in their own way, that there might be no other way of gaining the stones. Snowdrop liked it least of all. Except for Glass. I do not think she disliked the pig, but she certainly considered him an acceptable exchange for the stones. And if Pinky was willing to submit himself voluntarily, with a chance of surviving, her conscience need not be too troubled. Now I had complicated things for her.
Someone else must go with him, she said, looking around for a candidate. Not I, nor Lady Arryk.
Our minds will be needed.
And ours won't, asked Cater.
It's settled, I said. I go with Pinky. No one else. Then, to Glass, I understand that you consider me tactically valuable, although you still haven't had the decency to tell me how I fit in with your plans. But this will only give you more of an incentive to work on those weapons. They must work now. You can't run the risk of not getting me back alive,
and Pinky will benefit from the same advance preparation. Pinky drew his arms across his battle chest. I'll do just fine without riding your slipstream.
It will help us both, I affirmed, not wishing to be drawn into an argument.
Lady Arryk, we've seen the Nine Cats. I think you're right. If Glass can make them work with us, rather than against us, they'd be a useful infiltration tool.
Apparently you failed, Glass said.
Lady Arryk directed a sharp look at Snowdrop for this indiscretion, but she was much too wise to be goaded into a denial.
Yes, I did, in all senses. Even this demi-conjoiner could not get deeply enough into their programming before they began to fight back. But perhaps I lacked your tenacity and insight.
Glass looked sympathetic.
Perhaps you did.
Be aware of one thing, though, before Snowdrop allows you near our captured samples. From the corpses we found in the core, left there quite deliberately, like architectural flourishes, we know that conjoiners were sometimes set against the Nine Cats. They were alone, and likely handicapped, but not even their quick, bright minds were enough. The Nine Cats cut and gored them, and that was not all. Something got inside them and took them apart from the inside, perhaps not as quickly as one might wish.
Glass flinched. Some tiny moment of slippage, her control faltering. But she regained herself just as speedily.
Show me to your toys.
Can we depend on you with regard to both the Nine Cats and the Hemoclast? Lady Arryk asked, settling her hands before her.
By all means, suggest some other candidates for the work,
Glass answered reasonably.
You know that there aren't any.
Ah, good. Just needed that clarifying in case there was any doubt,
Glass considered.
But I will need some time. Some few days at the very least.
And when will you be able to give us an idea of your chances of success? Lady Arryk asked. The question seemed to puzzle Glass. She mock-frowned and cocked her head questioningly before some dawning realization broke her spell.
Oh, I see. You think there's some doubt, some likelihood that I won't succeed?
Yes,
I understand now. How silly of me not to have done so sooner.
Glass, I said, my patience straining.
Now, you have my assurance of success. Now. It will be done, Lady Arryk, just as I count on you to facilitate your own small contribution to the operation. The fact that I said I would need days in no way.
I think you can start your negotiations immediately, I interjected.
Good,
Lady Arryk said, blanking Glass even as she nodded at me.
We shall indeed do so, the instant the weather permits.
With regard to the Hemoclast, I said, once it's ready, do we need a period of familiarization, learning how to use it? You said it would be concealed about our persons. I'm still not sure how that's going to work, if we're examined.
Did I say about?
Glass asked anxiously.
That was an unforgivable slip if I did.
It goes into us, doesn't it? Pinky said, not about our persons, but inside them.
You could have mentioned that, I said, knowing full well that there had been no mistake.
The truth is,
Glass said, smiling as she gushed false concern,
the less you know about the Hemoclast before its time, the better it will be for you. And from what I can gather about the prototype, there's an additional consideration.
Which is?
I asked pleasantly.
There's no record of anyone ever using it twice.
Glass split her time between preparing the Hemoclast specimens and taming the captured Nine Cats. She worked quickly with the latter and was ready to show off her progress after only 3 days of study. A secure windowless room had been prepared near the Overlook. In its former life, according to Snowdrop, this was where the guests of the gaming complex were required to deposit privately owned weapons and anti-personnel toxins, lest any disputes turn violent. We stood with our backs to the wheel-locked door, Glass facing us with her back to the rear face of the room. She held a pliant Nine Cat, gripping it by its smooth, matte silver body with the nine arms draping down like jellyfish stingers.
"Have no concerns,"
she said, clearly relishing being the centre of attention, even with Lady Arryk in attendance.
The unit is now completely subjugated to my authority. It was simple, in hindsight. The Nine Cats engineers left a neural back channel, a means of accessing the deep programming layers. If they wanted to enter the core for maintenance, for instance, or to extract bodies, it allowed them to place all the Nine Cats into a temporary safe mode.
Why did none of their conjoiner victims find it in time? Lady Arryk asked.
Doubtless they tried. Maybe some did. It was one thing for me to map and probe the Nine Cats' control architecture at my leisure, when the unit was restrained behind a layer of hyperdiamond. Another for someone to search out those vulnerabilities when the Nine Cat was closing in on them, in the core, when they were likely already defenseless, weakened and handicapped.
All the same, I had the same opportunities as you, but I could not breach the fortifications. I felt the Nine Cat resisting, mounting neural counterattacks against my own architecture.
It was why we wouldn't let her carry on, yes, and verily, said probably Rose.
What can I say?
Glass asked rhetorically.
I persisted. Now, would you like to see what the Nine Cat can do for us?
She tossed the unit to the floor, bringing the Nine Cat alive in the same motion. The needle-tipped legs stiffened into arcs, cushioning the impact and elevating the body a few centimeters into the air. The legs' tips skittered against the polished surface, making a nervous pitter-patter. All of us, even Lady Arryk, pressed back a little nearer the door.
I'll need some reassurance that you really have cracked those security protocols, Lady Arryk said.
I'll let the Nine Cat demonstrate my control. I am sending it a neural command, asking it to establish a defensive cordon.
The Nine Cat scuttled from one side of the room to the other, tracing the same line, like a neurotic spider. It got faster, the pitter-patter becoming a blur of white noise. Soon it had become a silvery blur, like a low net stretched across the room.
Traverse it if you dare, Glass said. I wouldn't, though. Not if you value your extremities.
How good is it at telling friend from foe? I asked.
Sufficient for our needs.
I nodded at her non-answer, wondering what it concealed. I don't doubt that it's dangerous. Can it actually help us in the swine house?
Most certainly. The Nine Cats have the means to be biometrically locked to individuals, identifying targets or safe subjects. Again, it's a maintenance precaution. Before you enter the swine house, the Nine Cats will be programmed to recognize you as friendly parties. Not only that, but they will zero in on your positions, aided by the hemoclast. Wherever you are in the swine house, no matter how well guarded, the Nine Cats will find you and I will follow.
Quickly, I hope, I said.
Once the Nine Cats have found you, they will establish defensive perimeters similar to this. You will be protected for the short interval it takes for the suits to arrive.
So they'll recognize us, Pinky said. What about anyone else they meet while getting there?
The Nine Cats will avoid detection at all times, but should it be met, resistance will be neutralized.
And if these things run into some pissed-off pigs being held in meat racks?
They will recognize the phenotype and mark it at a lower priority for neutralization.
All the reassurance I needed. Thanks.
How many will we need?
Snowdrop asked, standing next to Pinky.
The more I send in, the quicker they can search the swine house. I have tamed one. I can tame 100 more.
The question isn't how many you can send in, I said. It's how many you can keep control of.
The answer is, as many as I deem necessary.
I turned to Pinky. I'm not sure I like it, but I like the idea of going in there without the Nine Cats even less. Are you happy with this part of the plan?
Happy's not the first word that springs to mind, Stink.
He lifted his snout challengingly, directing the gesture at Glass.
If you can make a few of these things work for you, send them in, but you'd better be coming in damn fast afterwards.
I'll fulfill my part in the exercise,
Glass answered. She snapped her fingers at the shimmering fence, and the Nine Cat sprung back at her, lobbing its central body into her palm and curling its legs around her wrist. She closed her fingers and lowered her hand to her side, the nine cat dangling limply.
"How many would you need?" Lady Alec asked. "I thought you might make do with 20.
20 would suffice, but the search pattern becomes more efficient if I have another 10, or even 20. I need hardly remind you that the speed of the search correlates strongly with Clavaine and Pinky's survival probabilities.
No, you need hardly remind me. 30, then, but only with the understanding that you remain in complete control.
May I have 10 more, for the purposes of destructive testing?"
Lady Arryk's tone was grudging.
"If you feel the need, but do not overexert yourself, Hourglass. You have more than enough to be getting on with in preparing the hemoclast. You are more useful to me, functional, than exhausted."
"I know my limits.
Fortunately, I can put one or other of my brain hemispheres into a sleeping state while the other remains active.
You should try it sometime."
The demonstration complete, Glass's audience filtered out through the open door, back into the warrens of the stronghold. Pinky shouldered past me without a word. I lingered, waiting until I was left alone with Glass.
"That was very well done. You were impressed by the nine cat?"
"No, not that part. The bit where you hid the injury it just inflicted on you." "Open your hand."
"There's no need."
"Then do it anyway. Why not, if you've nothing to hide?" Seizing the moment, I snatched the limp nine cat from her grasp, easily done since her palm was already slick with blood. I prized open her fingers. The blood welled out in pulses from a deep, vivid gash in the meat of her palm.
"You fool," I whispered. "It was an error, not a loss of control."
"I'm sure in your mind there's a very distinct difference."
"This is nothing, Clavaine. Just a slip."
"You're lucky you didn't lose your fingers. Those legs must cut like razors, and this wound needs treatment. You should go to Probably Rose."
"If Probably Rose speaks to Lady Arryk, then Lady Arryk will lose confidence in the operation and revert to her original plan of waiting.
Maybe that's not such a bad idea.
Except there are no other options. This must work. It will work."
Astonished, I understood that Glass was appealing to me. For the first time in our relationship, I knew something that could be damaging to her, and no amount of coercion was going to help.
"It won't happen again. I'm learning the control protocols a little more each time. That's why I want the other nine cats, so I can fully understand their limits."
"I admit there's a part of me that wants to see this through." I passed the blood-lathered nine cat back to Glass, almost as if it were a peace offering. "I won't mention this to Lady Arryk, or any of them, but you should get that wound looked at. If you don't trust Probably Rose, go back to Scythe and have the ship fix it." Glass held the nine cat in her uninjured hand. She stared down at the wound in the other, her face tensing in concentration. It was as if she were trying to puzzle out an equation. The pulse of blood began to slow, then stop altogether.
"I've got it under control."
"You can break," I said, marveling. "You're not some indestructible mannequin after all. You have limits."
"And that hurt, didn't it?" "I chose to allow it to hurt,"
Glass said defiantly.
"Pain is information.
Information is situational awareness," I said, and then frowned at myself because the words had come from somewhere within me that I did not care to explore.
"Right answer," Glass said.
I tensed inside my suit, preparing for the shock of entry. The simulations had prepared me for the fact that the loads would come on suddenly, and I was ready for that. Nothing in the mission planner's suite of training methods, though, could ever replicate the real experience of being shackled to a house-sized lump of Krondite rock as it rammed into the iron wall of the Martian atmosphere. Nor would that necessarily be the worst of what was to come. We were counting on the rock fragmenting a long way off the surface, but the exact timing and severity of that fragmentation was impossible to predict with any accuracy. All that could be said was that the four dropships, and the four suits inside them, and the bodies inside three of those dropships and suits were capable of absorbing a reasonable spread of predictive stresses. The one mercy was that we would more than likely black out if the conditions were at the extreme end of the range of survivable scenarios. Beyond that range, we would be safely dead, and probably falling to Mars in several molten pieces. With my dropship still attached to the rock, head first, so that the G-loading would tend to send blood into my brain rather than away from it, I waited for the first indications of the coming disintegration. There would not be much time between the rock's first encounter with the atmosphere and the thermal shock that eventually shattered it. But there should be enough of an interval to know when it was starting. Far from being an iron wall, the atmosphere was, in fact, nearly as tenuous as vacuum. But even a ghost-thin atmosphere presented a formidable obstacle to a lump of rock arriving from deep space at 30 kilometers per second. The majority of these incoming rocks never left any trace of themselves on the surface, shattering high up and leaving only a rain of hot, dusty gravel as a memento of their arrival. Once in a while, a rock stayed intact long enough to leave an impact crater. Mars was large enough that even these impactors were rarely worth the trouble of deflecting. I felt the first touch of atmosphere. The rock rumbled, like one iceberg grinding against another. I swiveled my view, looking either side, past the other dropships. The horizon, the edge of the rock only a few meters away, was starting to flicker with purple light. The rumbling sensation intensified. I felt the push of gravity as the frictional braking slowed the rock down. The purple light brightened to rose, then white. Tongues of flame bannered past, converging behind the rock. The ride was becoming rougher. Heavy jolts signifying the rock's imminent destruction. Pieces of it, fist-sized or head-sized, were already splintering. Beyond the curtaining fire, a wide arc of the daylit Martian surface had come into view. I had trained for visual recognition of landmarks, but nothing looked familiar. The dropships had drilled acoustic sensors several meters into the rock to detect the exact moment of breakup. The separation needed to be timed too precisely to be left to human control. A fraction of a second too early, and we would lose the camouflaging action of the explosion itself. A fraction too late, and the fireball would engulf us. I had always known that the moment would come as a surprise, and so it proved. To my eyes, the flames were just starting to shine more strongly, veiling Mars, and the jolts becoming more continuous. And then there was whiteness. And I was falling. The rock had blown up. I had been strapped to a megaton warhead until the last instant, and now I tumbled away from the expanding edge of the blast, one among hundreds of similar shards of debris surfing that bright, billowing edge. It would look convincing. It had to look convincing. There were going to be no second chances where the operation was concerned. If luck was on our side, the conjoiners might just be fooled by our ruse. Was it worth the risk, knowing we would never be able to pull off the same trick twice? Of course. Down there on Mars was the conjoiner compound, and inside that compound was an extremely high-value prisoner, one of our own, a man like myself, another knight of Cydonia, my brother, Neville. We knew he was alive. We knew also, through diplomatic back channels, that he had not undergone the usual fate of those caught by the conjoined. He had not been converted, not had their machines pumped into his skull, eroding his humanity and turning him into another unit in their massively distributed, conscienceless hive mind. They were holding back because of his status as an extremely useful bargaining chip. For now. The explosion was a fading, dirt-stained smear. Far above me. The dropship was falling on exactly the near-parabolic course that would be expected of any piece of fiery debris. It was even sloughing parts of its hull to mimic ablative heating. Somewhere out there were the other three ships, another trio of falling sparks, two of them containing hope and charity. But they were long past the point where I stood any hope of visual acquisition. If I could have acquired them, and distinguished them from the real debris, something would have been wrong. The ground came up hard, like a zoom in on a terrain map. One downside to our plan was that the dropships could not be seen to slow down as they approached the surface. Our mission planners had examined all feasible scenarios for getting three live bodies down onto Mars and concluded that the inhabited dropships could only commence deceleration measures when they were 500 meters up. This was going to hurt. But pain, as I like to tell my students in military planning, was situational awareness. 1 week slipped by, then another. Lady Arryk's stronghold swung around Yellowstone, its orbit carrying it to northerly and southerly extremes of latitude, but only occasionally coinciding with the position of Chasm City. As often as not, when it did, the atmosphere was going through one of its periodic fits of intense, colourful storms, smothering any trace of the city's location. Even the thermal hotspot of the chasm, where gases upwelled from deep in Yellowstone's mantle, was smeared into obscurity. Until the day Lady Arryk's laser signal received a pinprick flash of a return pulse, signifying that someone at the other end was listening and willing to respond. The transmission window closed before any meaningful dialogue could take place, but conditions remained favourable on the next pass, and the Swine Queen joined the communication circuit from inside her lair. It was voice only, and the window would close in 4.5 minutes. There would not be another opportunity for dialogue for 3 weeks. If the ransom exchange were to happen soon, all negotiations would have to be concluded within this window. Lady Arryk knew it. So did the Swine Queen.
"What have we to say to each other, lovely?"
asked the rough-edged voice coming out of the walls of the Overlook.
"You haven't called. You haven't asked after me. I thought we was done talking, despite my nice offer."
"Concerning that offer, would it still be open?"
"Well, if we're talking about the same offer, didn't you say I could shove it down my pork hole? That you'd never agree to it in 1,000,000 years? Had a change of heart, have you, lovely?"
"Everyone is entitled to alter their opinion, your swineness."
"That they are, but that really don't sound like you. No, don't sound like you at all.
You know how much I want the Gideon Stones."
"That I do. I also know how little you want to send your piggy pal down to me. What's changed?"
"That is between me and Pinky. Suffice it to say that I no longer have any objections to the terms of the exchange."
"Ah, but you're going to have to do better than that. You don't just wake up one day and decide to sacrifice your loyalist deputy. You wasn't willing to think about it 6 years ago, so why now?"
Aware as she was of the clock ticking down, Lady Arryk still risked a few seconds of silence. I admired how she held her nerve for the sake of a convincing performance. "A development has occurred. I thought I could count on that loyalty through thick and thin, but it seems I was wrong. Pinky always agitated for taking more decisive action against you. Immediate, forceful action.
Whereas you saw the benefits of waiting me out, knowing there's one or two who wouldn't mind sticking a knife in, moment my back's turned.
Heavy is the head that wears the crown, as a great man once said."
"And you felt the same itch when you had your back to him, did you?"
"I cannot blame him for acting in accordance with his nature."
Lady Arryk shuddered to say those words in front of Pinky. Doubtless he had heard worse, but they would have a particular sting coming from the mouth of his friend, even as she meant no harm by them.
"His kind cannot see the longer game. Waiting is inimical to them. They are creatures of impulse, driven by the need for immediate gratification in all matters."
The Swine Queen made an appreciative noise.
"So the scales have fallen from your eyes after all. Should have listened to me when I told you what him and his sort were about, lovely."
"I admit I saw more in him than was warranted, until he organized a move against me and showed his true colors."
"Yet you're still speaking."
"He gathered a small number to his side, but not enough to make a difference. I suppressed his rebellion and came to an arrangement with him, his life, in return for the others being spared."
That's nicer than I'd have been.
One turns against me, I gut and skin 10. Nosh on them in front of their pals, keeps them in line.
Sage advice, your swangness. Unfortunately, I don't have the benefit of your numbers. Those men and women disappointed me, but they are indispensable. I prefer to make one concrete example and give the others a chance to redeem themselves.
It's a mistake,
the Swine Queen said, with a sort of distant concern, as if they were two business leaders discussing opposing views of managerial strategy.
But it's yours to make, not mine. All the same, I still can't quite believe you've turned against Pinky. Not that I want to talk myself out of some noshing, but you were as thick as thieves.
I saw a side of him that was hidden before. An animal side, the beast behind the mask. I can't trust him or be comfortable with his presence now. He is less than I imagined.
Can't have been easy. I hate to say this, lovely, but you've nearly got my sympathy.
And you nearly have my thanks. But I must be honest with you about Pinky. Consider him damaged goods.
How so?
He was hurt quite badly during the failed rebellion. It makes my decision simpler. I know that I am not condemning him to an early death.
But, just so we're clear, you still know what I mean to do with him.
Yes, Lady Arryk said earnestly, and that will be on my conscience, such as it is. But that is part of the arrangement he and I came to. He accepts this price for the lives of his co-conspirators.
Lady Arryk drew breath. She looked around at the rest of the gathering, each of us conscious that she had reached the critical point in the negotiation.
May I presume, your swineness, that the terms of the ransom are still applicable?
I've still got the stones.
And I have the pig.
Then we'll do business. How soon can you get down here, presuming you've still got a ship?
We are monitoring heightened wolf activity. A sub-aggregate flow is passing between us and Yellowstone at the moment, but it should disperse in about 26 hours. If all is well, we would be able to make a rapid, stealthy insertion at any point thereafter.
Well, give us a day to dust off the landing stage and put some ammo in our guns. Not that I'm assuming any naughtiness, but
you would only be taking all sensible precautions.
Glad we're of one mind. You remember how to find us, don't you?
I think so.
Good. We'll roll out the carpet.
The signal crackled as the lasers lost their optimum lock.
And don't forget to bring the bacon. We'll have the spits turning, the griddles warmed. The culinary offerings have been a little on the tasteless side lately. This'll perk us up nicely.
A silence fell, once the transmission was finally curtailed. Lady Arryk placed a hand over the microphone, as if there were still a measurable risk of her words drifting down to Yellowstone.
I am sorry, friend.
Don't be, he growled. You only said what she needed to hear.
I want you to know that I don't.
The only insulting thing would be for you to think I didn't already know how you really feel.
He softened his tone minutely.
It's all right. Shit needed to be said.
Lady Arryk had not been lying when she mentioned the wolf flow passing between her stronghold and Yellowstone. Snowdrop was monitoring the flow's attenuation, collating whispers of intelligence from the dwindling assortment of sensors sprinkled in orbit around the planet. Some of these devices had been dispersed from the shuttle as it came in from John the Revelator, but others were native to the Rust Belt. Beacons, traffic monitors, surveillance nodes, and so on, that had been coaxed back into some kind of life, and programmed to make stealthy observations in the wave bands and modalities most likely to permit detection of inhibitor movements. Mostly it was impossible to see individual cubes going about their business, but when larger numbers of the units coalesced into a structural aggregate or an organized flow, there was a chance of detecting mass ripples or the occlusion of background radiation. The second hard part was relaying any of this hard-won data back to the stronghold in a way that avoided being sniffed out by the wolves themselves. As on Michaelmas, Snowdrop's network relied on ultra-low energy and frequency burst transmissions, disguised as random noise. It meant that the updates arrived sporadically, sometimes with many hours between them. After 13, the flow showed signs of attenuation, breaking up into sub-elements which flocked off in different directions, and by the time a day had passed, there was no clear sign of it. Only so much reassurance could be drawn from this, though. The sensor network was patchy, with significant blind spots. What the wolves were doing or planning in the shadows was open to conjecture. But we would never have any better guarantees. Scythe was the first ship to leave orbit. Glass took it out alone, exercising extreme caution and running all her stealthing measures. She nosed her way through the ruins of the Rust Belt, and then down into the interorbital space between the lowest flying debris belts and the sickly colored atmosphere of Yellowstone. Her last signal, tight beamed back to the stronghold, was confirmation that Scythe had not detected any lone wolf elements, nor seen any sign of larger groupings within its limited sensor horizon. Then Scythe dropped into the atmosphere, and we lost contact. Chapter 14. Before leaving, Glass had made all the necessary arrangements with Probably Rose. Partially dressed for the mission, but with additional armor and breathing devices still to be fitted, Pinky and I laid ourselves down on adjoining medical couches. Straps were then fastened across our bodies, which did nothing for my confidence. My forearm was left exposed, so that a transfusion catheter could be inserted without difficulty. With Pinky, it was easier to go in through the inner thigh. This part was unpleasant enough, since the catheter had to be large enough to handle a large blood volume. Since there was worse to come, though, it had been agreed that any sort of anesthetic was pointless. Then it began. Probably Rose wheeled the trolley into the space between our couches. The trolley had an upright rack, dangling with chilled blood bags, clear and full. Liter by liter, our blood was extracted and stored in the waiting bags, ready to be put back in us if we ever made it back from Chasm City. With each liter that was removed, another liter of an oxygen-bearing buffering agent was substituted. This was a medically safe blood substitute, proven for use in field surgery, and would produce no more than mild discomfort and nausea while it was inside us. It was intended to keep a person alive, and no more than that. The buffering agent was just an intermediate step. Once it was circulating, and we were deemed to have accepted it well, the real process began. Liter by liter, but more slowly this time, the buffering agent itself was replaced by the hemoclast, injected from a pair of upright metal reservoirs. I had been right about the name. The hemoclast was weaponized blood. It was the right color and a similar viscosity, and it could keep its recipient alive for an extended period. But there, all biological similarities ceased. This blood was a moving fluid made up of quick matter, tiny machines in a plasma-like suspension medium. Because it was distributed throughout our bodies and had density and ferromagnetic properties comparable with biological blood, it would pass all but the closest inspection. There would be nothing to show up on an X-ray, resonance, or ultrasound scan. It could manage oxygen transfer, although not as efficiently as normal blood. Inside our bodies, the hemoclast was a functioning, if imperfect, life support system. Outside of them, it was an adaptive, self-governing killing machine. But the cost to bear it was torment. It built slowly, liter by liter. To begin with, I thought I might be able to tolerate it quite well, something I could almost push to the back of my mind. By the third liter, I understood how wrong I was. The blood felt like a stream of lava circulating in me, burning me from inside. My heart labored, sending out sharp protests of its own. My lungs were like two bellows being filled with heavy, molten metal. Pinky and I tested our restraints. My body writhed and strained, my limbs tensing and untensing so violently that I felt they might rip themselves from their sockets. Within a few seconds, I felt that every already aching muscle had been shredded, every ligament severed. I would have screamed, except that probably Rose had given me something to bite down on. But even she seemed surprised by the ferocity of the reaction. On the couch next to mine, Pinky tried to swallow back a groan. He had forsworn the biting aid. Now I wondered if he regretted it.
"Glass says this might help,"
Lady Arryk said, as probably Rose pushed in the last liter of our torment. "The pain is a false signal, your body confused by the new circulatory medium. Merely knowing that may allow you to compartmentalize the discomfort."
"Tell Glass,"
Pinky began. I wrenched open my jaws and allowed the biting aid to loll away from my lips, trailing drool. Probably Rose had finished replacing our blood and was extracting our catheters.
"To shove it,"
I finished for Pinky. By some miracle, it did not worsen, and after a few minutes of doing nothing but breathing and thinking, I saw that there might be a point somewhere in my future where the pain could be endured. Just to be able to move and talk and think about something else for one clean second. Could I do that? The answer, when it presented itself, was simplicity itself. I had no choice. I was committed to this operation, and therefore I had to function. Even if there was no room inside me for anything but the pain, I had to lie to myself that it was otherwise, and in the narrow space of that lie, make myself useful.
"It's bad,"
I said aloud, testing the timbre and steadiness of my voice, and surprising myself by how resolute I sounded.
"But I think I can live."
"Glass is right. It's better when you remember the blood isn't doing as much damage to us as it feels like." Snowdrop came around, looking down at me.
"Does it hurt, Clavaine?"
"Yes."
"Keep the pain in mind. It'll be a tenth of what I'll do to you if Pinky doesn't come back."
"Oh, he'll come back,"
I said, grunting as I twisted around to look at him.
"How would I manage without his sparkling company?"
Then I pushed out a hand. "Help me, Snowdrop. He can look beaten up. It fits the narrative, but I have to look strong, at least until Lady Arryk cuts me loose." Snowdrop took my hand and yanked me into a sitting position. I breathed. The slight increase in oxygen demand made itself known in my chest, but compared to the fire threading every vein and artery inside me, that was no more than a dull ache.
"Thank you," I huffed.
"I mean what I said."
"I don't doubt it.
I'd far sooner have you on my side than against me."
"First intelligent thing you've said since we met,"
Pinky growled.
"Then we're finding common ground."
I braced for pain and swung my legs off the medical couch.
"I mean it, too, Snowdrop.
I saw the job you've done wringing some useful intelligence out of that sensor network. We struggled with the same problems on Michaelmas. The difference was we had hundreds more people and 10 times the technical resources you've managed with here. We could have used you." Snowdrop made a non-committal sound, not dismissing my words but unwilling to show that she was moved by them. I understood well enough.
"Bring those stones back to us, and maybe some of this won't have been for nothing."
Probably Rose came back with a couple of tablets palmed in her hand.
"Take one of these, yes. Glass said they'll dull the symptoms for a little while, and verily."
The pills looked alike, so I selected one at random and swallowed it whole. It scraped down my throat, dry and tasteless as a pebble. "Why didn't you give us the pills before injecting the blood?" Probably Rose looked at me as if I had asked a deliberately vacuous question.
"Because you needed to know what it'll be like when they wear off."
"How soon?"
2-3 hours. "Yes and yes. I'll be in the shuttle, along with Omori, if something goes wrong. Once you're outside, though, you're on your own."
"And if something did go wrong, I don't imagine there'd be much you could do about it. Am I right?" Probably Rose looked torn between candor and reassurance. Clearly, there was little of the latter she could offer.
"And verily, well,
luck's been on my side so far. Why would it desert me now?"
"I don't know you very well, Clavaine. I think you are a tissue of lies walking around in the shape of a man.
I think you may have done many bad deeds.
Very probably.
But this is a good thing that you do now. Yes?
Thank you, I breathed.
Whether it was that crumb of kindness from probably Rose, or the effect of the pill, I felt an easing in me, a simmering down of the fire. It was still there, nothing that I would call pleasant, but momentarily bearable. I looked at Pinky, who had also taken a pill, and hoped that he was feeling a similar respite. Snowdrop was leaning down to him, whispering some promise in his ear, and I looked away just as they kissed, feeling that I was intruding on their privacy. I'll bring him back, I vowed to myself. It was as much as I could do. Chasm City was nowhere beneath us, and then it was everywhere. We had come through the last layer of cloud, above a plain of ruins. It took a few moments for my eyes to adjust to what I was seeing, a few more for my brain to accept the scale of destruction and the toll of murder that it implied. I knew what had happened here. I knew the punishment that had been dealt against us for having the hubris to turn our eyes to the stars. But no intellectual understanding could have prepared me for the visible evidence of our downfall, graven in the ruins of our greatest metropolis. The worst thing was that it was still possible to tell that this had been a city. A blackened carpet of ash, a glass-fused crater, a scoured blank absence would have been easier to process than the half-incinerated remains beneath us. Ruins told a story. Kilometer upon kilometer they stretched, the black or ashen remnants of what had once been buildings as big as mountains, now reduced to hunched, crouching, mangled forms, like pitiable, slouching figures under cowls and cloaks of sackcloth. They were hollow-eyed, hollow-skulled, blown right through. Some of them had fallen over, or taken one or more with them in the same collapse. Pieces of buildings lay among the ruins, jammed upright like jagged tombstones. Draped over everything, yet mostly so diaphanous that we saw right through it, was the collapsed shroudwork of the city's domes. Nowhere was there a trace of movement, nowhere a light or flash of living matter. I had accepted that there were pockets of survivors down in Chasm City without question, but now it seemed preposterous that any organism, much less any group of people, could have found a way to live there. The city slid under us, monotonous and terrible, until in the grey haze of distance we could make out the chasm itself, the belching maw at the city's heart. Lady Arik slowed us further as we neared the incurving lip, the ruined buildings crowding near the edge in tightening spirals, like processions of ships about to tumble into a whirlpool. Turbulence increased. Thick, unhealthy coloured clouds were still rising from the chasm, hiding anything more than the upper fraction of its depth. The shuttle stopped altogether and began a cautious, queasy descent.
"Are you all right?"
probably Rose asked both of us. "No worse," I said. "Pinky?"
"No worse,"
he echoed, and I thought that if we could agree on that much, even in our discomfort, there might yet be hope we'd come through this together. We lowered beneath the chasm's rim, and I saw how the buildings had spilled over the edge and down into the shaft, pushing ever deeper as the real estate above ground became more congested and expensive. The remains of bridges grasped across the chasm without meeting. Lady Arik navigated us around these buckled, sagging hazards, draped with acres of dome that had come raining down. Slowly the walls were rising past us, the sense of confinement and claustrophobia increasing with each kilometer that we descended. Only a poor sort of daylight made it through Yellowstone's clouds to begin with. There was not much left of it by the time we were 5 kilometers into the chasm. Yet as the gloom intensified, and the fluted and striated walls seemed to press in on us like a tightening throat, so I made out the first signs of active habitation. Lights and fires glimmered from a dozen widely spaced points in the wall, like eyes in a night-lit forest. Then 100 more, as I adjusted to the spectacle. The band of habitation seemed confined within 1 kilometer or less of the chasm's height. "They do not use those fires for heat or cooking," Lady Arik said, noticing my interest. "They are territorial markers, lines of division between little dwindling empires.
You might as well be looking at a map of planetary systems slowly being snuffed out by wolves. Already there are fewer signs of life than there were 6 years ago. They're dying off, one by one. Very little else to do in the long run. There were no sustainable resources left behind when the city fell. The gangs subsist off scraps, stored commodities, what little they can steal or barter from others. And if that fails, I said quietly, there's always a bright future in cannibalism. Not the most sustainable lifestyle choice, if history has been any guide. You have a gift for understatement, Lady Arryk. At times I even think you might have a sense of humour. I do. But I've learned from bitter experience that it's best kept to myself. She nodded into the mist, at a structure emerging from the chasm's depths. There, Clavain, our destination, the swine house. Study it well. In a few minutes you are likely to be somewhere inside it, suffering terribly. Are you a sadist? I asked. No, merely a realist. Well, you're right. You really should keep that sense of humour to yourself. The swine house was built out from the chasm side, like a faceless wall clock, buttressed from beneath by huge splayed and angled supports, which rested on natural ledges 100 or so metres beneath the underside of the lair. That was about as far down as we could see before thicker layers of mist closed in. Augmenting these supports were numerous tensioned cables, radiating out from fixtures in the lair's sides and corners, and cleated directly into the wall, through whose narrowing gaps we had to pick our way. It would be exceedingly bad manners to clip one of those lines, even though the loss of any one of them would not be sufficient to send the lair tumbling into the chasm. Do you think Glass managed to get all this way without being seen? We must depend on it. Not quite the answer I was hoping for. She will have achieved her initial objective. Scythe's stealthing systems are far in advance of this shuttle, and besides, we wish to be seen. Our Glass will have come in silently, keeping close to the opposite wall and using the mist and adaptive hull camelioflage for cover. She will be waiting now, positioned some way beneath the swine house, and certainly out of reach of our sensors or any surveillance devices available to the Swine Queen. When we send the signal, she will rise to the base of the structure and commence her infiltration. Do you think we can rely on her? We are different in our methods, different in our philosophies. She is the lightning. I am the weather system. But she will not fail in her aspect of the operation.
And it ain't because she cares about me, Pinky said, or pigs in general.
You may not like me, I said, or respect me, and in your shoes I probably wouldn't either. But I have a feeling you are much more valuable than Glass realizes. She would be making an error if she treated your life as worth anything less than my own. He looked at me skeptically.
You done, Stink.
Yes. Good. I've spent my whole fucking existence being told I matter, usually about 30 seconds before I become inconvenient to someone.
Did you matter to Neville Clavain?
He wasn't the same. Then nor am I. I said quietly, if you mattered to him, then you matter to me. The upper part of the lair was too complicated to be called a rooftop. It was a jumble of different levels and lookouts, crisscrossed with ladders and walkways, and bristling with spiked defences and slitted, swivel-mounted turrets. The turrets tracked us as we came in. Perhaps there was nothing in them that could do serious harm to the shuttle, but the message was plain enough. We were only one twitch away from a less than cordial welcome. Now would not be the time to get off on the wrong footing with the Swine Queen. Hemmed in by spikes and turrets, but nevertheless accessible, was a flattened landing surface marked by a crudely daubed cross and lit with flaming beacons. Lady Arryk slipped us between the last of the wires, put out the shuttle's landing gear, then sat gently down on the pad. I think we wait for our hosts before making any moves, she said. There was time for Pinky and me to fix on the breather masks we would need for the handover. We eyed each other, neither having anything to say. Perhaps a certain taciturn distance was the best way of getting into character for the performance ahead anyway. Glass's pain reliever was still doing its work, but with every breath, I knew that the hemoclast was going to reassert its presence sooner or later, and I needed to be ready for the moment. Figures came out of a squat building on the edge of the pad. There were six of them, masked and armored and carrying weapons that resembled long muskets, connected by hoses to tanks worn on the figures' backs. Flamethrowers, I guessed. As if any doubt remained, one of the figures elevated the muzzle of their weapon and squeezed out a tongue of blue-edged fire.
"Yes, very good," Lady Arryk said aloud, as if there was the slightest likelihood that your swineherds would come unarmed.
We were ready. Probably Rose, Amori, and Lady Arryk donned their own breathing equipment. Amori and Probably Rose went through the lock first, taking armaments of their own but evidently not feeling the need to show off their capabilities. Amori and Probably Rose stepped off the shuttle, then walked a short distance across the landing area until they were within speaking distance of the reception party. Pinky and I watched proceedings through the viewing ports next to the airlock. The reception party all had full face masks on, old-fashioned, leathery-looking affairs with round portholes for eyes and snout-like protuberances where an air hose went in. I had been staring at them for a few seconds before my perceptions jolted. They were pigs' faces, made into masks. I started to say something to Pinky, some necessary acknowledgement of this abomination.
"Save it, stink."
A tense exchange was going on between Probably Rose, Amori, and the reception party, clearing haggling over the final terms of the exchange. More than once, members of one or both parties turned away, feigning a breakdown in the agreement. But it was all gamesmanship, all theater. They were never going to put up an objection to the handover this late in the process, and neither were we. But both parties had an understandable desire to see the goods before the trade. Something was signaled back to Lady Arryk. Outside, two of the reception party went back inside the building. A minute or so later, they reappeared with a trunk hefted between them. A third figure had joined them, one I instantly understood to be the Swine Queen herself. Around her waist, she wore a blood-stiffened leather apron, down which hung an assortment of butchery tools, among other objects whose function was not immediately apparent. She was broader and taller than I had been expecting, her armor more ostentatious, her mask more visibly betraying its origins. It was just a pig's head, mouth and snout, eyes and ears, still intact, tilted back so that her masked and goggled face was able to see out between the jaws. If the other masks were made from the face of hyperpigs, then this was something atavistic, a throwback to the genetic basis of Pinky and his kind. The mask was hideous. Its horror lay not just in the way it was worn, so crudely jammed onto her head, but in the denial it made concrete, that ones such as Pinky or Snowdrop were anything but a small step above the beasts. The Swine Queen had been an abstract antagonist until now, an obstacle we had to work around. Now I saw a madness that needed to be extinguished, a mind gone so far wrong that it was beyond humane salvation.
"Perhaps we should take the stones by force," I said, wanting nothing more than to turn the shuttle's weapons, which I was certain existed, even though I had not been shown them, against her swineness and her masked retinue.
"And then find out there's nothing in that box except air," Lady Arryk said. "Now, my nemesis has thought this through just as thoroughly as we have. I shall inspect the goods. Follow me, but remain by the shuttle until I signal for you to approach. Then, to Pinky, whatever happens today, you've shown a bravery beyond words. If there had been no other point to my life, I would consider myself blessed to have shared this little part of space and time with you. You are the best of us, my friend, the reason that we are worth saving, and I promise you this, there will be justice."
Then, to me, "Bring him back, Clavain." Lady Arryk went out first, then we followed, waiting as instructed at the shuttle. Slowly and deliberately, Lady Arryk drew out a small Boser pistol. She held the weapon aloft, cupping it loosely in her semi-opened palm with a finger hooked through the trigger guard, ready to use in an instant, but not yet aimed at anyone in particular. To be seen to be carrying a weapon was necessary etiquette. Lady Arryk walked to the trunk, now lowered to the ground. The Swine Queen stood behind it, arms folded. At a gesture from the Queen, two of the guards flipped open the lid and allowed Lady Arryk to look inside. Lady Arryk looked to the Queen and mimed dipping her hand into the box. The Swine Queen nodded, her loose-fitting pig mask joggling horribly, and echoed Lady Arryk's gesture in an exaggerated, sarcastic manner. Lady Arryk knelt, still with the pistol dangling from her fingers, and scooped out one of the Gideon stones. She turned slightly so that I had a better view of the upraised object. It looked real to me, but then my only point of comparison was the one inside the stronghold. Lady Arryk held it close to her eyes, turning the object slowly. She lowered it back into the trunk, gave the Queen a peremptory nod, signalling her acceptance that the goods were not counterfeit. Lady Arryk rose to her feet and stepped back. The guards sealed the box again. The Swine Queen made a quick series of gestures. If she spoke, I heard nothing. Lady Arryk walked back to about halfway between the two delegations. Two of the guards followed her with the trunk, then set it down again. Unless there was some spectacular sleight of hand going on, the stones must still be inside it. Lady Arryk turned to me only.
They're good. Bring him, Miguel.
He can walk on his own.
I said bring him,
she snarled. Falling into my role, I seized a buckle around Pinky's back and shoved him in the direction of the Swine Queen. Pinky twisted out of my grip and snarled back at me that he did not need to be encouraged. The Swine Queen spoke. It was an amplified version of the same rough voice we had heard over the laser link, but now it emanated from the pig mask.
Why all the shoving, lovely? I thought you said he'd agreed to come of his own will.
Lady Arryk called back.
That was all well and good a day ago. It would seem second thoughts have begun to occur in the presence of your swineness.
Well, don't be tenderizing him ahead of time. That's my job.
The mask fixed itself onto me.
Who's this?
Not that it matters, but one of my associates.
I don't think I know him.
There's no reason that you should. His name is Miguel de Reiter. He was one of Pinky's main allies in the move against me.
Funny that you'd trust him with this, then.
Who said I do?
We were nearly at the trunk. This was the moment I had been waiting for, while at the same time mentally blocking as far as possible. Lady Arryk did something very quick and deft with the Boser pistol, twisting it in her fingers like a party trick, and aiming it not at the Swine Queen or any of her party, but at me. She fired. The yield had been dialed down low enough not to be lethal, the beam at its narrowest setting, and her aim had been precise enough to inflict exactly the damage she wished, and no more. The pulse clipped me in the upper thigh, drilling through flesh and muscle. I yelped and went down, my leg giving way under me. I let go of Pinky and he staggered away from me as I hit the floor. Lady Arryk's shot had caused the Swine Queen's guards to jab their flamethrower muscles in our direction, and one of them let off a quick, sweeping plume. But any further retaliation was curtailed by the Queen herself, raising an arm.
No! Don't burn them! That was meant for him, not us.
The mask waggled as she nodded some kind of approval.
I take it this man didn't wiggle his way back into your good offices?
I writhed and groaned. I still had a part to play, though no part of my performance needed to be forced.
De Reiter was good, until he wasn't,
Lady Arryk said, with a distant regret.
After we spoke, I realized I needed to make a firmer statement about my authority. I have you to thank for that, your swineness.
In which case, you're welcome.
Do with De Reiter as you will. Kill him if you like, or find some use in him. His loyalty is malleable, as I learned. That may work to your advantage in the short term.
Nothing tricky going on here, Lady Mac.
Lady Arryk nodded at my shivering, whimpering form. Does that look tricky?
On balance? Maybe it doesn't.
Have fun with him. I don't know if your taste yet extends to human flesh, but by all means, experiment.
Oh, we will.
Then if our business is done, may we consider our exchange concluded?
The Swine Queen's mask gave a twitch of mild affront.
In a hurry to be leaving?
A hurry to be anywhere but this dying cesspit of a city. No offence.
None taken. Much. But we're not quite done. Or were you thinking I'd accept your honesty without question? I might be mad, lovely, but I'm not gullible.
The Swine Queen unhooked a thick-rimmed, hoop-like device from her waist, a sort of metal lasso. The handle ended in a coil of wire which fed back into a box, which she held in her other hand. Four of the guards reached Pinky and me. They took hold of Pinky by the arms, easily lifting him off his feet, and they wrenched me from the ground with no concern for my wound. The Swine Queen walked up and dropped the hoop over my head and down the full length of my body, the guards forcing my arms tight about me so that the hoop could keep descending. Her mask drooped as she studied a flickering grey readout in the box. The device made a musical tone as it worked, rising and falling in pitch. She repeated this procedure for Pinky, evidently satisfying herself that we were not armed.
Take your stones for now,
she said, hooking the hoop and box back onto her waist.
For now?
Lady Arryk asked.
You've passed the first test, but we'll want to have a closer look at this pair before we let you slip away for good. Hold your ship on the pad until you get the say-so.
Lady Arryk directed Probably Rose and Amori to help with the trunk. Aren't you the slightest bit curious about what I need them for?
Something grandiose, I expect. Something pointless. Something that won't make a difference. You go off and do whatever it is you think will help, lovely. Enjoy yourself. Meanwhile, we'll be down here noshing our faces off on meat and blood until our brains rot or the lights go out. Whichever's first.
That sounds like a very reasonable arrangement, Lady Arryk said.